Hello. For those of you who do not know me, my name is Stephanie. I am the palliative care nurse practitioner here at Jacoby. And today I'm going to be talking to you about how to talk to your patients about advanced directives. So when should you talk to your patients about advanced directives? Ideally, it really should be on the first clinic visit, every time you meet your patient, and any time after that, especially if there's been a change in the patient's status. And also, every time the patient is admitted to the hospital, because again, that designates a change in status. So it's really, really important to talk to patients about advanced directives because of patient autonomy. Really, all patients with decision-making capacity are entitled to make their own decisions. And what you want to make sure is that they have some way of telling you what their decisions are and what their wishes would be, even if they can no longer speak for themselves. So, if healthcare professionals do not initiate discussions regarding advanced directives, this can result in a lot of different problems. One is delays in treatment, especially if the families are really trying to struggle to think, you know, what would mom have wanted in this, you know, in this circumstance. There's also could be conflicts between the medical staff and the families regarding goals of care. Well, the team wants one thing and the family wants something else, and you know, we have to try to figure out exactly where the patient's voice is in all of that. And also, it can cause a lot of patient and family distress and dissatisfaction with care. You know, a lot of this, like, why didn't you tell me sooner? Or, I wish I could have known this earlier because then maybe I could have had a discussion with mom about, you know, so those kind of things. So, the most important one to complete is a healthcare proxy. And this allows a patient with decisional capacity to designate somebody that they know and trust to make medical decisions for them if they're not able to do so for themselves. It's a legal document. It's witnessed by two people. The witnesses cannot be the proxy or the alternate. And there's also, just to let you know, there's no need to get a lawyer involved. There's no need to get this notarized, anything like that. Okay. And actually, I have here something on how to complete a healthcare proxy. I'm going to be hanging these around the nurse's station so that you always have something that you can refer to. Basically, in order to complete a healthcare proxy, first of all, if the patient is still able to speak, check with them, make sure that they haven't filled out a healthcare proxy previously, or check with the family, see whether the patient had filled one out. On the electronic medical record, there's also an advanced directives tab that you can look through to see whether there's any documentation if the patient had a previous healthcare proxy. And also patient relations. Patient relations has a set of about 10 binders that hold all of the hard copies of healthcare proxies that patients have completed. And so if you're not sure, you can always call them and ask them to look through their files and see if they have anything. So now the next step is, if the patient has decisional capacity, you can fill out a healthcare proxy form. And decisional capacity is something that you as a treatment team can decide whether or not the patient has that. There are some patients who might have the decisional capacity to name a healthcare proxy, but they might not have the capacity to make more complex medical decisions. But something as simple as a healthcare proxy, who do you trust to make medical decisions for you, can still be done. So this is a color-coded completed healthcare proxy. I made it nice and creative so that you don't get creative. The most important thing is obviously the name of the patient. It's always good to put the medical record number on the top as well, because after the fifth Jose Rodriguez, you'll find out why they need the medical record number on here. So you need the name of the first healthcare proxy. Make sure that you have as much information as possible in order for us to be able to get in contact with them. Home number, cell phone number, address, you know, all that information. The patient also has second alternate healthcare proxy. And also you need all of that information for them. Now there's a phrase down here at the bottom under optional. which says, my proxy knows my wishes about artificial hydration and nutrition. Basically, what that means is that the healthcare proxy can make any and all decisions regarding the patient's medical care. In New York State, food and fluids are considered an even higher level they're kind of at a very high level of regard, basically. You need a lot of proof if you want to say that somebody would not want a feeding tube placed. You need a lot of proof. But if you have something like this on the healthcare proxy where it says, my proxy knows my wishes, then that proxy can say whether or not this patient should or should not receive a feeding tube. Then the other thing important is the patient signs up here. We've had the patient sign in all sorts of creative places, but really it needs to be signed up here. A lot of times they sign down here under organ donation, then it really isn't a legal healthcare proxy, so make sure that they sign up here. Also put the date on it. It's very important to date these, and also date where the witnesses have signed, because sometimes patients make two or three healthcare proxies, and you need to know which one is the most recent one. And also, that kind of proves that the witnesses were actually in the room when the patient signed this proxy, so that you don't have a different date. There should be two witnesses. Again, it should not be the proxy. It should not be the alternate. It can be anybody. It can be a nurse, doctor, social worker, you know, somebody who's just, you know, somebody's lying in the next bed. It doesn't really matter. All that they're saying is that they saw this person place their pen on this paper and say, this is who I trust to make the medical decisions for me, and that nobody was trying to coerce them. The patient can't really sign very well. An X is just as good. And if you have a case where a patient absolutely cannot sign because they're paralyzed from the neck down, they can still designate a healthcare proxy. Just have to document very clearly that the patient is unable to sign due to paralysis or whatever it is, and that they can't even make a mark on the paper. Okay. All right. So, again, with a healthcare proxy, the designated proxy is legally able to make medical decisions on behalf of the patient. Without a healthcare proxy, the surrogate can only make a decision about DNR. That's it. If they feel that the patient would have wanted withdrawal of treatments, or that the surrogate is somehow in conflict with a medical treatment team, call in the cavalry. Call in palliative care, call in risk management, call in patient relations, whoever you can to help resolve these conflicts, and we'll all be happy to help. Okay? For a healthcare proxy, if a patient has documented not to have decisional capacity, and again, documentation, I can't stress this enough, the healthcare proxy can be engaged to determine what the wishes are of the patient for DNR, for artificial hydration and nutrition, if that's part of the clause in the healthcare proxy form. They can also make decisions about withholding and withdrawing treatment, such as ventilators and hemodialysis. The surrogate, again, in a patient documented not to have decisional capacity, where a healthcare proxy was never identified, nothing was ever signed by the patient, the surrogate can only make decisions about DNR. And you really, in this case, you need a consensus from all of the immediate family members if you want to make somebody DNR. A lot of times what we've seen is that a patient who does not have a healthcare proxy, one of the family members signs the DNR, and the team says, well, I spoke to the son. Well, okay, but there's a daughter in California who doesn't agree with the DNR. And that means that there's a conflict within the family. You really need to make sure that everybody is in consensus. And if you have problems, call us in. Call in palliative care, call in risk management, call in patient relations, and we can help you out with this. We'd rather get too many calls than too little. Okay? All right. So, just to give you some examples, these are things that we've seen we have seen often in the chart. Something like, the family has decided on comfort care, will withhold all further treatments, or no cancer workup per family's wishes. Because again, if the patient does not have a healthcare proxy, the surrogate cannot make decisions about comfort care, about, you know, stopping all of the treatments. But what you can do is that the medical team feels that any further aggressive treatments would provide little or no benefit to the patient and will cause increased discomfort. Recommendation is to make the patient comfort care, and then the patient's wife is in agreement. Simple as that. Or discuss the health plan of care with the patient's healthcare proxy. We'll pursue aggressive treatments based on patient's known and expressed wishes. It's a little bit of a different spin. It basically ends up being the same thing, but it's just a little bit of a different spin. That it's not the family making these decisions, but that the treatment team is making these recommendations and the family is in agreement. Okay? So what we're really trying to avoid is something that I call the salad bar. So really, you shouldn't be asking the family, do you want us to do dialysis? Do you want us to do intubation? Do you want us to do antibiotics, pressors, blood draws? You know, all this crazy stuff. It's really, you know, you have to decide as the treatment team, do the benefits to the patient outweigh the risks of the treatment? And if so, then the treatment really should be done. If the patient has a healthcare proxy and the healthcare proxy says no, this patient would not have wanted this, then you can have them sign a refusal of treatment form. If it's a surrogate that's saying, you know, if it's a family member, a son, daughter, wife, whoever, that's saying that no, the patient would not have wanted this, again, call in palliative care, call in risk management, call in patient relations to help kind of iron things out a little bit. I mean, I've seen a lot of times, especially with something like pressors. Well, you know, even with the healthcare proxy, a lot of times it's very difficult to ask them something like that. Usually when you have a healthcare proxy, you talk about, you know, maybe you talk about DNR, maybe you talk about dialysis, maybe you talk about ventilators. But pretty much nobody would say, you know, if I'm in this kind of a state, please do not put me on pressors and please, you know, do not do blood draws and those kind of nitty-gritty details. It's really something that the treatment team should make a decision on. If you feel that the patient would benefit from it, you really should just go ahead and do that. If the patient is septic and you think that, you know, just by giving them some pressors for a couple of days, it'll get them over that hump and then they'll be doing okay, you really should be able to just do that and just let the family know, you know, this is what we feel is the best thing for the patient and this is what we're going to do. Okay. So, let me see. All right. So when you're discussing a healthcare proxy, usually the kind of the spiel that I give to my patients is, in New York, every patient needs a healthcare proxy. If for some reason you are not able to speak for yourself, it gives a family member or close friend the legal authority to assist us in making medical decisions for you based on what they know of your wishes. Okay? Because New York is an interesting state. New York, and I believe it's Missouri, are the only two states in the country where there is no family surrogacy law. Any other state that you would go to, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, wherever, if a family member says, don't do this, the doctors say, okay, because that's, you know, they can trust that the family is making, you know, the right decisions based on the patient's best interest and all that. New York, you can't do that. In New York, you need a healthcare proxy. And especially, you know, in somebody who is not legally married, or somebody who has, you know, no official, you know, sanctioned relationship with a patient. They absolutely have no say. And so, especially in those cases, it's really, really important to fill out a healthcare proxy. So if somebody has, you know, comes to the clinic, and every time they come to the clinic, they bring their best friend because they trust their best friend to help them. That would be a perfect opportunity to say, you know, especially if your best friend, you know, this would help make sure that they would go to the best friend over somebody who's, let's say, like an estranged, you know, husband or estranged spouse or something like that. Okay. So before I continue on, I just want to check in and see whether there are any questions or anything. I know that this is a lot of information to digest.
wants to designate somebody as their healthcare proxy, and then you hear from neighbors and whatever that that healthcare proxy may not be the best person as for them. Like, let's say the patient wants their son to be the healthcare proxy.
Okay.
The neighbors know that he's not very reliable, he's not very supportive, because he's not really there for her. Do you still let the patient do it?
You really have to, because, you know, the patient feels that they can trust their son. You know, and I'm not saying that you can't steer it in a little bit of a different direction by saying, okay, well, that's fine. You can name your son. Is there anybody else you want to designate as an alternate? So just in case the son flakes out and you can't find him anywhere, you have somebody else to go to. Or the son all of a sudden says, you know, I really can't make this decision. This is too difficult for me. Then you always have somebody else to fall back on. We have done that, you know, that we try to really push the patient to get somebody else, you know. And other times, you know, we just talk to the patient and say, you know, ask around, because you might think right off the top of your head, you know, oh, you know, I think my husband would be the best one to be my healthcare proxy. And then you go home and you talk to him and you realize that he would, for example, you know, you feel very strongly that if you're ever in a, let's say, a persistent vegetative state, then you would not want to be kept alive on a ventilator. And your husband tells you, I would never pull the plug on you. You know right away that that is not the right healthcare proxy for you. You have to find somebody else for you. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
In the case that you do not have a healthcare proxy, you only have a surrogate.
Mm-hmm.
You can only decide about DNR.
Right.
Okay. Let's say that you want to do a certain procedure, or you do not want to do a certain continued care for our patient because you feel medically that it's not appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And the family disagrees. Who makes the final decision?
Again, if there's any sort of conflict, the medical treatment team feels that this is the best way to proceed with for this patient, and the family says, no, I don't think so, we don't agree, you have to call in help.
Yes.
And the final decision, it's really what we're trying to do in that case is we're trying to ascertain what the patient's wishes are. And generally, the patient's wishes are usually what we go by, if it's strong evidence of what the patient's wishes would be. If it is, for example, if the treatment team feels that continuing treatment is really not in the patient's best interest, that, you know, they feel like they're being maybe a little bit too aggressive with this case, the patient is not likely to recover, and the family says, no, you have to do everything. A lot of times what we'll do when, you know, after we've met with the family and the family says, you know, the patient really would want us to continue trying, we'll tell them, you know, let's do a trial of treatment. I love trials of treatment because they just buy you another extra week or so. They say to the family, you know, listen, we've tried. We've tried absolutely everything, and nothing is working. So even though we've tried all the antibiotics that we can, even though we've tried, you know, all the treatments that we can, this just is not working. So we're not trying to discontinue anything that might work. We're just going to stop all the treatments that we know are no longer effective.
And that there is no healthcare proxy for any invasive things, which you think may not work, including blood transfusion or anything. Who makes the decision again if there is no healthcare proxy?
Well, if a family can, you know, a family can sign a consent form. You know, a surrogate can sign a consent form, but it's really more that they're assenting rather than consenting. You know, it's really that they. That the treatment team says, you know, we feel that this is the best thing for the patient, and the family says, okay, fine. And that's really not really, it's not really a consent, it's an assent.
So is it really necessary to get a consent form from a surrogate?
Yes.
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 It's not an official consent.
Right. But what they really can't do is they can't refuse. You know, they can't say, no, I'm not going to sign that. You know, in that case, again, you have to go to risk management, palliative care, patient relations. We have, in a couple of instances, done like a two-physician consent because the family refused to sign it. There was one instance of a patient who was on a ventilator for quite a lengthy period of time, and we really needed to put a trach in. And he had prostate cancer, but it was not anything exciting. It wasn't metastasized or anything like that. He had a number of other chronic medical conditions, COPD, all of that, but nothing really that would limit his life expectancy all that much. With the ventilator support, he could likely have, would likely be living for another year or two. And when we sat down with the wife, she really couldn't tell us what the patient's wishes would be. And she said, I'm not signing anything. I don't think he would have wanted the feeding tube. I don't think he would have wanted the tracheostomy, but she couldn't say why she felt that way. And again, we also didn't have we had a patient with a fairly decent prognosis. And so in the end, we took it up to risk management, and they said, do a two-physician consent. The patient got the trach, he got the feeding tube. I saw him lying in the bed like a week later. The nurses were all saying that he was flirting shamelessly with him and everything. So it really was a very, very good outcome that way. But that's how. Okay.
If a patient is there who's in a minimally responsive state, blinks his eyes at times, and his has peg and trach done on support, his support, and he wants to transfer him to a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
But the daughter with the SCD says that she's unwanted, and the patient is here for months, and that's the same situation. So what do you do?
Transfer
to a nursing home or just keep him on the
floor? But in that case, the patient does have a
healthcare
yes. Yeah, but if the patient is stable and there is no reason for the patient to remain in the hospital, the social worker really should, initiate. There are certain things that I'm not familiar with, but the social worker can initiate certain things to say to the family, we have three facilities that we can offer you that will take care of this patient, and, we really have to discharge this patient, and then I think there's some way of threatening them with a hospital bill or something like that. But generally, even if they don't have a healthcare proxy, I think the social worker usually can get involved and assist with difficult discharges like that.
Yes, but we have a lot of patients who are on the floors, who are in a vegetative state, and they cannot go to a nursing home because the family doesn't want, or the healthcare proxy doesn't want the patient to be transferred anywhere else.
They don't have that option. The family doesn't really have that option. If there is a safe alternate place for this patient to go to, then the social worker really needs to push that. And the social worker also has resources. The director of social work, and also, again, patient relations and risk management to go to if there are difficult cases like that. But the patients really shouldn't be here just because the family says that they don't want them to be transferred. Okay. Other questions? It's generally seen as a conflict of interest. Generally, it's preferred if it's somebody who's, a family or a close friend. Even if it's a PMV that the patient has known for years, it's generally not seen as a good idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not legally possible to do that.
Yeah. No, if you have a relationship with patient in the clinic, and you want to document the patient's wishes on your clinic note, you can do that. And that will help, whoever the patient does designate as the healthcare proxy to kind of help guide them about what kind of decisions the patient would have wanted. to have made. That's really what you can do as a PMD to make sure that the patient's wishes are followed, is to document some of those wishes in your chart. But you really shouldn't be the one that the patient designates as the healthcare proxy. Other questions before I move on?
So there are many patients that don't have anybody. They don't have a family member or somebody else that can be a healthcare proxy, or I mean just be by their bedside. And then if the PMD document is very wishes in terms of like certain procedures not to be done or intubation or anything, and the patient is not mentally kind of
right,
that set of mind that can make the decision, will those documented wishes be taken into consideration?
Absolutely, absolutely. In that case, it would be that the patient, the case would definitely come either across palliative care risk management or patient relations, and we would definitely look through some of the notes from the PMD or call the PMD if it's an outside PMD and ask them what they know of the patient's wishes and help to kind of reestablish the patient's voice that way. Absolutely. Absolutely. But generally, patients always have somebody that they can name. I mean, I know that there are some exceptions, but generally, everybody has somebody that they can name.
We had a patient recently who had, as you mentioned, she had a healthcare proxy. The patient was not able to, you know, really make any sort of decision capacities. And on the healthcare proxy form, it said that the healthcare proxy knows the patient's nutritional desires.
Mm-hmm.
And so the healthcare proxy told us that the patient didn't want to have any tubes, mm-hmm. but when it came time to make a decision, we would decide she what the patient was no longer eating. The healthcare proxy said, I can't let her starve to death.
Okay.
So what do you do when you have a healthcare proxy that's told you what the patient's wishes were,
mm-hmm.
but the healthcare proxy can't follow through?
Okay. Well, I mean, that's actually kind of goes a little bit off tangent, but sure. Patients with dementia, the natural process for patients with dementia is that as their dementia progresses, they gradually lose interest in food and fluids. So they become more and more bedbound, they become more and more withdrawn, and then they lose interest in solid foods, then interest in pureed foods, and finally they lose interest in liquids. And that really is a natural progression of the disease, and it should be explained to the family that it's not starvation, because it isn't. It's really, technically, it's more dehydration than starvation. It's a very natural process. It's a very peaceful process. Starvation implies that the patient is hungry and that you're withholding food from them, even though they're hungry. But these patients aren't hungry. They might be a little thirsty, but if you give them some ice chips, a mouth swab, something like that, they're generally, that sensation of thirst is alleviated. So, again, with a patient who has a healthcare proxy, who has that clause in it that says that they know their nutritional wishes, and the proxy says, no, the patient would never have wanted a feeding tube, you can reassure them and say, you know, patient is not starving. When, you know, if she's able to swallow, if she has a good day and she's able to swallow, we will be happy to give her something to eat, happy to give her a sip of liquids, you know, something, maybe even just nectar thickened, something like that. But we're not going to starve, you know, it's not a starvation process. Dehydration, it's basically, you know, they kind of slip into this coma-like state. The body releases endorphins. It's very, very peaceful, natural process. This happens with dementia patients. It happens with cancer patients. It's not starvation. Okay. And again, that kind of thing for dementia patients can only, unfortunately, be used if you have a healthcare proxy, and that healthcare proxy has that, you know, my proxy knows my wishes. Other questions? Anything else? Okay, all right. So now, DNR. Another fun topic here. All right, DNR, do not resuscitate. And this is an end-of-life decision, and it needs to be addressed before the end of life. We've seen a lot of times where you know that the patient is getting sicker and sicker and sicker, and then all of a sudden one day you find out that the patient is so sick that they can no longer make decisions about DNR, and so now you're going to the family to ask the family what would the patient have wanted. And really, it's something that you need to address with the patient while they're still able to do so. So really, every patient who's diagnosed with a chronic life-limiting illness should have a DNR discussion. Cancer patients, HIV patients, end-stage renal patients, severe COPD, CHF patients, especially patients who are on home oxygen. You know where this is going. You really need to have a discussion early on, because you want to have the patient, you don't necessarily want a decision from the patient right then and there. You want the patient to start thinking about what their wishes are. Okay. So these are some statements to avoid when you're talking about DNR with patients. What should we do if your heart stops? Do you want us to do everything? Or my favorite is CPR means that we're going to pound in your chest and break your ribs while you restart your heart, and then we're going to stick this big tube down your throat and hook you up to a machine to breathe for you. Do you want us to do that? Oh, wait a second. Or one of my other favorites is, I think CPR would be futile for your loved one. These are not really warm and fuzzy conversation openers. Okay. So really what you want to do first and foremost is always make sure that the patient understands their diagnosis and their prognosis before you have a DNR discussion. If the patient knows that they have metastatic cancer, but they don't know that they have less than 6 months to live, they're probably going to give you a different answer than if they know that they have a limited life expectancy. So you always need to make sure that you have that prognosis in there. All right. So a helpful statement to make is, I need to discuss something very important with you regarding further treatments. Would you like anyone in your family or friend to be present with you when we have this conversation, or would you like to defer all of this decision-making to your healthcare proxy? Some patients feel very overwhelmed. They don't want to have discussions about end of life. They don't want to make decisions about DNR and all of that. They just say, you know what, I know that I have a really bad disease, but I just don't want to make any decisions about it. It's much too overwhelming for me. Just talk to my healthcare proxy about it. I trust them. They know what my wishes are. Just let them make those decisions. And that's perfectly fine. So really what you could do is, for example, considering that you have these diagnoses with a prognosis of, let's say, days to weeks, I feel that performing CPR would cause you significant pain and distress, while the chance of it being successful is slim to none. Therefore, I would recommend a DNR order. However, I want to emphasize that we will continue treating you in all the other ways that we have been doing. It puts a very different spin on it. It's not asking the patient, what do you want us to do? It's telling them, based on this, based on this, based on this, my recommendation is this. It's very different. It's taking it off of their shoulders and telling them, this is my recommendation to you. It's a very different spin, again. And actually, just in terms of the prognosis, it's a lot easier to give a prognosis of days to weeks, weeks to months, or months, rather than trying to decide, is this patient to have about 3 months or less to live, or 6 months or less? Kind of telling them those kind of vague parameters usually is enough to kind of give them a little bit of an outline of what to expect. And that way, it's not like they have an expiration date stamped on their forehead. Okay. All right, so the different DNR forms that you, I'm sure, know and love and are completely confused about. So, 6 DNR forms in this hospital. All right. So, the yellow form, this is the first one. This is an adult patient who has the ability to make decisions about a DNR. The patient gives verbal consent to a doctor and to another witness. The patient does not need to sign anything on this form. And then the attending physician also needs to sign this in order for it to be put into the computer as an order. This is a blue one. I don't think I've ever seen anybody use this form. This is very, very unlikely that you're going to use this form. The only time that you're going to use this form is with an adult patient where the patient will suffer immediate and severe injury from a discussion of CPR. Like they're going to run and jump out the window as soon as you mention CPR or something to that effect, I guess. If you do use this form, it still needs a signature of a surrogate. And then as well as two physicians before putting an order into the chart. The list of surrogates is on here. It starts off with an individual designated by the patient, which is a healthcare proxy. The next level down is a court-appointed committee or a guardian. The next level down is a spouse, and make sure it's a legal spouse. Make sure that they're not a common law or anything like that. The next one down is a son or daughter aged 18 or older. We have had 16-year-olds sign consent forms. This is not good. If you're not sure, ask for some form of ID to make sure that they're over 18. A parent, a brother or sister aged 18 or older. And also, close friends can sign DNR forms, but if a close friend signs it, it needs to be notarized along with a statement of that friend saying that I know this patient and I know that this is what the patient would have wanted. If you're confused, just ask. Because you will be confused. Took me ages to figure these out. All right, the third one, this is the white one. This is actually should be used a lot more frequently, but it isn't. This is a patient who no longer has decisional capacity, but who at some previous point has already filled out a DNR. It could be a DNR that's in the nursing home. It could be what's called an out-of-hospital DNR from the community. Or it could be a DNR from a previous admission. This does not need a surrogate signature. All it needs is a surrogate consent. So just let the family know, you know, based on the patient's previously expressed wishes, we're going to continue the DNR here. And then it just needs, again, two attending physician signatures before you put it in the chart as an order. Next one is a pink one. This is probably the one that you see used most of the time. This is for a patient who does not have decision-making capacity and who has never consented to a DNR previously. Again, it needs a surrogate signature. And it also needs two attendings. We've seen a lot of these forms where the attending only signs in one spot. There are probably about three or four spots where the attending needs to sign and about three or four spots where the concurring attending needs to sign as well. So just make sure that everybody has signed where they need to sign and that nothing is left blank. This one, the green one, is one that I've also seen very, very rarely used. This is a patient where they do not have decision-making capacity, they've never had a previous DNR, and they have no surrogate. This means that they have absolutely no family, like that case that you were mentioning. They have no friends, they have no family, they have absolutely nobody. The social worker has looked absolutely everywhere under every rock, and we cannot find anybody. And there are two physicians that feel very strongly that this patient should be a DNR, and that's when this form is filled out. And the purple one is only for pediatrics. Okay. Just another quick note on this non-hospital order to resuscitate. This can be found on the Department of Health website. It can also be found by paging me. I have copies that I carry around. This really should be given to any patient who is a DNR, who is going home. It also should be given to patients who are leaving the hospital who have a DNR order here, especially if the nursing home that they're going to is not in the Bronx or is farther away in the Bronx and you think that they might not be quite stable for the trip, or you just want to make sure that nothing happens during the trip, you want to give them this. All right. Okay, so I think I already went through that. All right, so the last one that I wanted to go over is DNI. Yes, of course.
What is the form for DNI? How do you convey to somebody that he's full code? Like, if there is a discussion about DNI, the patient agreed to be full code, for example, and you send him out to the nursing home, anybody over there would think, seeing his prognosis or diagnosis, that the patient could be again our status, but they don't know whether he actually consented or not. Nobody could care about that.
No, well, it's always presumed that the patient would want CPR unless it's designated otherwise. So you basically always assume that a patient is full code unless you have some paperwork somewhere that says otherwise. And that's why it's really important, if a patient is DNR here, to send them home, if they're going home, to send them home with something like this. Because that way, the EMTs that come to the house when the patient has died do not try to resuscitate them. Because if they do not see this form, they will resuscitate the patient, or try to anyway. But it's always presumed that the patient would want CPR. All right, so DNI. There is no such animal in the state of New York. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. It's really a medical decision. It's something that the treatment team should decide whether the patient would or would not benefit from this treatment. It's a patient with lung cancer who is dying, who has probably hours to maybe a day or two to live at the most. Putting them on a machine to breathe for them is really not going to give them any measure of benefit. It's only going to prolong their suffering. It's not going to give them increased comfort or anything like that. This is probably a case where the treatment team would make a decision not to intubate the patient, and you can just let the family know that, you know, especially if the patient's already DNR, you know, we're not going to intubate this patient. We're going to treat his difficulty breathing with other less aggressive measures, BiPAP, oxygen, you know, Ativan, morphine, whatever need, you know, whatever could help the patient. And in those cases, again, call palliative care. We're glad to help out with those cases. If it's a patient who still has decision-making capacity, or if the patient has a healthcare proxy, and for example, this patient is a very, very severe asthmatic, and they've already been intubated 3 or 4 times, and they've told you very, very clearly, if this ever happens to me again, I do not want to go on that breathing machine ever, ever, ever again. Do not do that to me. You can have them sign a refusal of treatment form for intubation and mechanical ventilation. If it's a surrogate, they cannot sign a refusal of treatment form, just like with all the other treatments. They cannot sign a refusal of treatment form. Call palliative care, call risk management, call patient relations, and we can try to help out and see exactly what's what. Okay. And that's pretty much it. So questions. I know that I've gone over a lot of information. I don't expect you all to memorize all of this stuff. It's very, very confusing. It can be very, very difficult. Palliative care is always happy to help. You don't have to call us in for a full consult. We'll be happy to curbside. If you're not quite sure if you're doing the right thing, call us in, ask us again. We'll be happy to help. We'll be happy to answer your questions. Questions that I can answer right now?
Can you let your pager?
Pager. Okay. You don't have that? Okay. I'll get some more. Do I know my pager number? 917-219-4652. Is that right? Keep me honest here. Yeah, okay.
One question.
Of course.
So if a patient already had a DNR order and a prior admission,
mm-hmm.
they come in for a second admission,
mm-hmm.
we already have documented in our system.
Yep.
We use the white form.
Yes.
We have to have a new form filled for every admission.
Yes. 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 And if it's possible, you know, attach some sort of documentation that says that the patient was a DNR previously. Either call medical records to get the previous signed DNR form on the chart, attach the out-of-hospital DNR form, attach a note from house staff that says, you know, this had a long discussion with the patient wants to be DNR, that DNR form placed in chart, that kind of thing, to make sure that way we know that you're using the right form. Because this one, again, doesn't require a signature, just requires a consent from the surrogate to reinstate it. Other questions? Okay. Any questions about palliative care? No? Okay. All right. Well, again, if there's just briefly, if there's any patient with a chronic life-limiting illness who's having some sort of symptoms, who's having any sort of emotional distress, where there's if there's family conflict, please call us in. Be happy to help. We do a lot of stuff with pain management, symptom management, dyspnea, and some, you know, even some basic things: constipation, dry mouth. Tiredness, a lot of those kind of all stick together. So we can help out with a lot of those things if you need help, or if you just want to curbside us just to check and make sure that you're doing the right thing. I will be on the ambulatory block. I'll be talking about some pain management and how to order pain medications correctly and all of that. If you do have questions about pain management, you can always call me. There's also a nurse practitioner through anesthesia called Denise, who's also the other pain guru here, and she can also help you out with those kind of questions. Okay. Hi. Thank you.